Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1360, Birds of a Feather, part one. This is being recorded on November 23rd of the year 2024. Yesterday was Friday, November 22nd of 2024. That was the 61st anniversary of the assassination of JFK. As that, by the way, that also took place on a Friday. And as I've noted in many programs and in recent programs as well, the assassination of JFK was a coup d'etat. The United States is not a democracy. It does not have a free press. And there's no, quote, left, unquote. The, quote, left, unquote, is run by the CIA, and it's used to divide people, turn them against one another, and to piss them off. And it does a very good job in that regard. Now, the title of the program, Birds of a Feather, is spelled B-Y-R-B-S, B-Y-R-B-S, excuse me. And it's a reference not only to David H. Byrd, or Dryhole Byrd, the owner of the Texas School Book Depository, from which Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly fired the shot that killed the shots that killed President Kennedy. In fact, he didn't fire any. There's no evidence whatsoever that he even fired a gun that day. He certainly didn't kill President Kennedy. And it also is a reference to other birds of a feather. And the David H. Byrd, or Dryhole Byrd, as he was known, not only owned the Texas School Book Depository, but he was the founder of the Civil Air Patrol. And Lee Harvey Oswald networked with David Ferry going back to the Civil Air Patrol. And among the people in that unit as well was the late Barry Seal, one of the top CIA drug smugglers. I'll put a link in the written description for that, or to that material that comes from the late heroic Daniel Hopsicker's website, madgalprod.com. Now, in these two programs, we're going to be accessing some magnificent research. One article, the first one up, is by Jeremy Kuzmarov, and we're also going to access a very important blog by Russ Baker, the author of Family of Secrets, from his Who, What, Why publication, and also something from Dan Alcorn as well, who's been a really important piece of research on some of the I wouldn't call them peripheral connections, but the further exploring the flock of these birds of a feather. Again, that's spelled B-Y-R-B. Now, the first article comes from Covert Action magazine of November 21st of 2004. It is by Jeremy Kuzmarov, capital K-U-Z-M-A-R-O-V. And it is titled LBJ Insiders, D.H. Byrd, and James Ling bought 132,000 shares of stock in defense contractor LPV, or Ling Temco Vought, in November of 1963, around time of the JFK assassination. And this just goes to show you that they were, in a sense, profiting in connection with the death of JFK. That's not meant to be P-R-O-P-H-E-P-I-N-G, but P-R-O-F-I-T-I-N-G. And the introduction to the article by Jeremy Kuzmarov is as follows. This article, timed for the 61st anniversary of the JFK assassination, discusses the importance of David H. Byrd, one of Lyndon B. Johnson's closest friends in helping to orchestrate the JFK assassination. Founded in the 1970s, Covert Action Information Bulletin was among the few publications to publish critical research into the JFK assassination. Last year, on the 60th anniversary, we published an article detailing LBJ's role in the JFK assassination that readers may want to consult in connection with the below article. And by the way, LBJ was certainly involved, as was Richard Nixon, as was Ronald Reagan in a more peripheral way, as was George H.W. Bush, the man for whom CIA headquarters is named. And the first section of Jeremy Kuznarov's article is called Documents Accessible at Library of Congress Confirm Purchase. In November of 1963, the month of JFK's assassination, two of Lyndon Baines Johnson's closest friends, David H. Byrd, again that's spelled B-Y-R-D, and James Ling, L-I-N-G, bought 132,000 shares of Ling Temco Vought or LTV stock at approximately $16 per share through the Alpha Omega Corporation investment vehicle. Byrd already owned 19,948 shares of LTV stock at this time, and his wife, Mattie, capital M-A-T-T-I-E, owned another 15,796 shares, which were collectively worth about $571,904. By the way, that was a whole lot more money in the early 1960s than it is now. Continuing. As a founder of one of the companies that merged to become LPV, Ling also, like Byrd, owned thousands of shares before the November 1963 purchase. Housing plants in Dallas, Garland, and Greenville, Texas, LPV was a defense contractor that made Corsair airplanes for the U.S. Navy and, according to Byrd, became a, quote, formidable presence in the aerospace industry, unquote, after it absorbed the Chance Vought Corporation. That Vought, again, is V-O-U-G-H-T. By 1967, in the middle of the Vietnam War, LPV stock rose to a whopping $169 per share and had a total value of $22,308,000, which in 2024 dollars would be equal to approximately $207.3 million. David Byrd and his wife thus made an absolute fortune both from the Alpha Omega investment vehicle purchases and from 35,744 shares of LTV stock they owned separately from Alpha Omega. LPV stock was boosted by President Lyndon B. Johnson's granting a large defense contract to LPV in February of 1964 to build the A-7 Corsair II, a light attack aircraft equipped with autocannon and MK-82 bombs, which was used extensively in the Vietnam War. And even though LBJ campaigned on a peace platform, already the escalation and the bombing of North Vietnam and the escalation of the Vietnam War was in the cards. It was in the works. LBJ simply lied in his 1964 campaign. Continuing. Confirmation of Byrd and Ling's stock purchases discussed in Peter Dale Scott's 1971 manuscript, The Dallas Conspiracy, and 1996 book Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, is found in the 1964 Value Line Investment Survey, which is accessible at the Library of Congress. The stock purchases are significant in pointing to the likely involvement of Ling and Byrd in the JFK assassination conspiracy. It shows they were ready to profit from JFK's death and may have known about it in advance. The buys occurred at a time when LPV stock was heading downward in the face of antitrust litigation. Furthermore, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara said to brace for cuts in the defense industry, and the business press was writing bearish articles on the prospects for defense stocks as the year 1963 was coming to a close. On October 7th of 1963, Newsweek published an article titled, quote, What can industry do as Pentagon cuts back? Question mark, unquote. By August 2nd, 1965, Newsweek published an article called, quote, War's Widening Ripples, unquote, and wrote that, quote, the shock waves from the escalated war in Vietnam were spreading through U.S. business last week, unquote. Byrd was the owner of the Texas School Book Depository building on the corner of Beery Plaza in downtown Dallas, from which Lee Harvey Oswald is alleged to have shot JFK. the PSBD, that's the Texas School Book Depository Company, was owned by Jack Kaysen, head of the Dallas Post of the Right-Wing American Legion, and a friend of J. Edgar Hoover. The Texas School Book Depository distributed textbooks to schools in Dallas. It appears to have functioned as an intelligence front, which covertly shipped military and intelligence-related items in book cartons. Elsie Glaze, of capital E-L-Z-I-E, last name capital G-L-A-Z-E, a reporter for the Austin American Statesman, researched and interviewed Bill Shelley, Oswald's supervisor, and noted, quote, "Mr. Shelley claims to have been an intelligence officer during World War II and thereafter joined the CIA," unquote. Oswald was himself an undercover intelligence agent who had covertly infiltrated the left-wing Fair Play for Cuba Committee as part of an operation to provide him with a cover that made it possible to blame the Kennedy assassination on a left-wing communist. Evidence indicates that Oswald could not actually have been one of the snipers, as he was seen by two witnesses, police officer Marion Baker and Texas School Book Depository Superintendent Roy Tooley, calmly drinking a Coke on the second floor of the Texas School Book Depository 2 minutes after the assassination, which would have been impossible if he had shot JFK from the sixth floor. By the way, we spoke about that. And among other programs, the long 27 one-hour series of interviews on JFK Revisited. Continuing. Also, Oswald received at best average grades for marksmanship in the military, when the sniper would have had to have been a top expert to have hit Kennedy from the Texas School Book Depository sixth floor. Further, evidence indicates that Kennedy was shot from the front from the grassy knoll, and that there were more bullets than Oswald is alleged to have shot from the Texas School Book Depository. For years after the JFK assassination, Byrd kept a replica of the sniper's nest from the Texas School Book Depository in his mansion as a souvenir/trophy. Byrd had been essential to the JFK assassination plot as the one who helped enable Oswald's hiring and owned the building used in the plot. Afterwards, to prevent critical scrutiny into his actions, Byrd created a fake alibi that he was in Mozambique on a hunting safari at the time of JFK's assassination. Byrd was such a close friend of LBJ, the primary beneficiary of the JFK assassination, who had a raging hatred for the Kennedys, that Johnson allowed him to land his plane at the LBJ ranch any time he wanted. Byrd was also a very close friend with Clint Murchison Sr., a wealthy Texas oil man connected to organized crime, Curtis LeMay, a right-wing militarist who hated the Kennedys, and Malcolm Mac, unquote, Wallace, one of LBJ's alleged hatchet men who worked for Byrd at LPV after he avoided jail time on a murder charge, that is, Mac Wallace. Byrd, additionally, had employed George DeMorenfield, a CIA operative who served as Oswald's handler. Again, very important. We've spoken about George DeMorenfield in many programs. Not only was the highly educated, multilingual George DeMorenfield a very different kind of person than Oswald ostensibly was, George DeMorenfield also was arrested during World War II for allegedly having spied on the Aransas Pass Coast Guard Station for the Axis. His uncle, Baron Hugo Maybell, was for a time in charge of all Abwehr activities in North America. The Abwehr was German military intelligence. And George DeMorenfield's brother, Dmitry DeMorenfield, worked for Radio Free Europe, which is a CIA front organization. And DeMorenfield himself was a member of the Solidaris. That was a white Russian organization that worked with the Third Reich as part of the what was to coalesce as the Galen organization. So, again, George DeMorenfield is a very important person and someone about whom we have spoken at length in the past. Continuing and repeating this last sentence. Byrd additionally had employed George DeMorenfield, a CIA operative who served as Oswald's handler. a cousin of Governor and then Senator Harry F. Byrd, Democrat of Virginia, who is described as, quote, the leader of the conservative opinion in the U.S., unquote. David Byrd was born on April 24, 1900 in Detroit, Texas, and dropped out of the University of Texas after his sophomore year to work in the oil fields, where he became a millionaire by age 30. Byrd recounts in his memoir, published in 1978, that he gained the nickname Dry Hole Byrd because he drilled 56 dry holes before striking it rich. He became the largest independent producer in the oil business after he was mentored by Colonel A. E. Humphreys, quote, King of the Texas Wildcatters, unquote. Crediting the Texas oil industry with hoping to catapult the U.S. out of the Depression and enabling the defeat of the Axis powers in World War II, Byrd wrote that he was, quote, tired of being the whipping boy or object of envy because he made money at an honest trade, unquote, and that his central concern, quote, is to shout from the rooftops when I still can against the government meddling that has now beset the oil business for so long. The country is now choking in government controls, unquote. By the way, the spindle pop oil fields in Texas were also the thing that gave the Mellon family and Andrew Mellon much of his wealth. And the Mellon family became part of the American oligarchs, and they were Timothy Mellon. From that family was the primary, the largest single contributor to Donald Trump's campaign and also to brainworm Bobby Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s presidential bid, which ultimately was folded into the Trump campaign. Continuing. Byrd and other Texas oil wildcatters, who staked their fortunes in part on Lyndon B. Johnson's political rise, hated John F. Kennedy because of his threat to remove the oil depletion allowance or special tax subsidy that oil companies receive because oil is a finite resource. A member of the CIA front groups, the Dallas Council on World Affairs, and the Crusade for a Free Europe, Byrd was a national security insider heavily invested in the aerospace industry. He owned two major CIA contractors, Collins Radio, which developed early radio systems for the CIA, and E-Systems, a company that specialized in building spy equipment. In 1975, at the CIA's request, E-Systems purchased the CIA proprietary airline Air America, which had flown arms and opium in support of CIA-backed paramilitary groups in the Indochina War. By the way, Collins Radio was also linked to Mr. Mather, a friend of J.B. Pippitt, and one of the people who was driving a car, or a person linked to a car, which was allegedly used by Lee Harvey Oswald, which was allegedly driven by someone identified mistakenly as Lee Harvey Oswald. This is one of the many Oswald impersonators we discussed in some of our programs dealing with JFK assassination chokeholds. I'll put a link in the written description for the program. Continuing. John Mintz wrote in the Washington Post that E-Systems was, quote, almost indistinguishable from the CIA because it operates so secretly, lacks accountability, and is loaded with retirees from the CIA and other intelligence agencies. For decades a fixture in classified work, it is accustomed to selling its wares only to the intelligence community and doing it secretly, unquote. By the late 1930s, Byrd co-founded the Civil Air Patrol, or CAP, an Air Force auxiliary used for covert operations. As a CIAP recruit, Lee Harvey Oswald was sent to the Army Counterintelligence School in Maryland to, quote, be taught the Russian language, Russian military tactics, Russian politics, and all characteristics of the Russian people, unquote. Byrd was close with General James Doolittle, an aviation pioneer who wrote a report on the CIA in 1954, which concluded that, quote, it is now clear that we are facing an implacable enemy whose avowed objective is world domination by whatever means and whatever cost. There are no rules in such a game. If the U.S. is to survive, long-standing concepts of, quote, fair play, unquote, must be reconsidered. The Doolittle Report, called for more aggressive CIA covert activities that had previously been believed to be repugnant and contrary to American values. Byrd's right-wing sensibilities were evident when he traveled to Nazi Germany several years before World War II and had a brief meeting with Hitler. When Byrd returned to the U.S. after the encounter, he spoke positively of Hitler's, quote, sincerity, unquote, and, quote, basically sound policies, unquote. One more time, because one of the things that is just a real frustrating head-scratcher for me personally, and this is not to find fault with the many wonderful researchers who have done such a great job of presenting the JFK truth to us over the decades, but by God, one of the things they just don't like to do or don't do for whatever reason is to talk about the many Nazi connections to the JFK assassination. One of those is George Nornfeld. More about that later. And D.H. Byrd is one of those. Repeating the last paragraph. Byrd's right-wing sensibilities were evident when he traveled to Nazi Germany several years before World War II and had a brief meeting with Hitler. When Byrd returned to the U.S. after that encounter, he spoke positively of Byrd's sincerity. When Byrd returned to the U.S. after that encounter, he spoke positively of Hitler's, quote, sincerity, unquote, and, quote, basically sound policies, unquote. Byrd subsequently developed a close friendship with one of Heinrich Himmler's former assassins, Werner von Alvensleben, last name capital Alvensleben, a double agent in World War II, who owned and operated the big game hunting company that Byrd allegedly traveled to in Mozambique with at the time of the JFK assassination. One more time, I misread that. Byrd subsequently developed a close friendship with one of Heinrich Himmler's former assassins, Werner von Alvensleben, a double agent in World War II who owned and operated the big game hunting company that Byrd allegedly traveled to Mozambique with at the time of the JFK assassination. And by the way, of course, Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS. And by the way, D.H. Byrd not only was one of the people who traveled to Nazi Germany and thought Hitler was great, but William Donovan, as a high-priced lawyer and already operating as an agent for the J.P. Morgan interests, had what was described as a sympathetic lunch with Adolf Hitler in 1923. That was obviously before November 9th of 1923, because that was the date of the beer hall putsch. And we have the, Freudian slip. Adolf Hitler wasn't alone. He wasn't crazy. He was an undercover German army intelligence agent operating for the political department of General von Lassow in World War II. Continuing, Byrd's memoir amazingly makes no mention of Kennedy or the JFK assassination. He alludes to his friendship with LBJ, featuring a photo of him with LBJ at the University of Texas football game at the Cotton Bowl in Dallas, but barely mentions any details of their symbiotic relationship and how Johnson helped to make him rich. A Covert Action magazine investigation detailed how LBJ was almost certainly a central figure in coordinating the JFK assassination through intermediaries such as his lawyer, Ed Clark, whom Reader's Digest had called, quote, the secret political boss of Texas, unquote. Clark privately bragged that his fellow lawyer, Barr McClellan, the last name capital of Barr, capital B-A, Barr, McClellan, capital M-C, capital C-L-E, double L-A-N, about his involvement in the JFK assassination. His motivation was that he derived a lot of his money, lucrative oil leases and large legal retainer fees, and power from his long-time association with LBJ, who awarded Clark with the ambassadorship to Australia, a key American ally during the Vietnam War. Johnson's motive in orchestrating the plot to kill Kennedy stemmed from the fact that the Kennedys were plotting to remove Johnson as vice president on the 1964 Democratic ticket for the election and destroy him. I think that should be described as one motive. There were others as well. Again, that event, 11/22/1962, was a coup d'etat. LBJ was certainly part of it and an important part of it, but he was only part of it. The Kennedys were leaking to the media and Republicans in Congress information about Johnson's criminal activities that could have put him in prison for the rest of his life. Johnson had become an embarrassment because of his associations with two white-collar criminals who served as his financial bagmen, Billy Saul Estes and Bobby Baker, who were both being brought down in financial scandals and facing long prison terms. Clayton Burkett Van Kirk, that's capital B, middle name B-U-R, capital B-U-R-K-E-P-P, Van Kirk, chief counsel in 1963 for the Republican minority on the Senate Rules Committee, told journalist Seymour Hersh that Attorney General Robert Kennedy was feeding damaging information on Johnson's corruption to the Senate Rules Committee in the fall of 1963 in an attempt to destroy LBJ. Van Kirk told Hersh that, quote, Bobby was feeding information to Whispering Willie, nicknamed for Senator John Williams. The Kennedy brothers, unquote, Van Kirk said, were, quote, dumping Johnson, unquote. By the fall of 1963, Lyndon Johnson was acutely aware of and extremely agitated about the Kennedys' plan to politically destroy him with coordinated media exposés into his epic corruption. As part of Johnson's inner circle, Byrd looks to have played a pivotal role in helping to consummate the Kennedy assassination, in which the Texas School Book Depository was obviously critical. Byrd also owned the Bal Pex building adjacent to Dealey Plaza, where snipers allegedly shot at JFK, and a radio operator connected to the Mafia, Eugene Hale Brading, helped coordinate the assassination hit team. According to Sarah Jordan Heinz, capital H-E-I-N-T-Z, Byrd have allowed the CIA and the Israeli Mossad to run ops from the Bal Pex building and store weapons in it. Byrd was part of the so-called Sweet 8F group, a collection of right-wing businessmen who held meetings in Sweet 8F of the Lamar Hotel in Houston. Other members of this group included George and Herman Brown, key Johnson benefactors who founded Brown and Root Company, which built military bases in Vietnam and then eventually, by the way, I would add, became a subsidiary of Halliburton Oil, presided over by Dick Cheney, continuing Jesse H. Jones, former chairman of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and future Texas Governor John Connally, and Ed Clark. Billy Saul Estes wrote in his memoir that a slush fund of more than $1 million was raised to fund the Kennedy assassination by people affiliated with the Sweet 8F group, including Byrd, who played poker at Brownie's Restaurant on East Grand Avenue in Dallas, a favorite gambling place of the local business elite and Dixie Mafia elements since the 1960s. The men were concerned that, if Johnson were dumped, the state of Texas would be without a power base in Washington, and the oil depletion allowance and defense contracts would be in danger. According to Spartacus Educational, a website devoted to the JFK assassination, Byrd was connected to key CIA figures linked to the JFK assassination plot through his membership in the Dallas Petroleum Club. The figures included George de Morenfield, David Atlee Phillips, who told his brother on his deathbed that he had been in Dallas at the time of the JFK assassination, likely an admission to his involvement, and George H. W. Bush. Researcher Richard Bartholomew has suggested that Byrd knew David Ferry, a CIA operative prosecuted by New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison for his alleged involvement in the JFK plot via the Civil Air Patrol, or CAP, whose Texas wing Byrd commanded. The stock trades carried out around the time of the JFK assassination give further weight to the belief that Byrd was involved in the assassination in some way or was aware of the plot, from which he ultimately benefited greatly. And that, again, from a very important article by Jeremy Kuznarov in the Covert Action magazine from November 21st of the year 2024. And one of the articles that is referenced and footnoted by Jeremy Kuznarov in that article, and again, the entire article will be available in the print section of the written description for the Record 1360, and that was a characteristically excellent article by Russ Baker. Russ Baker is a journalist with whom I was privileged to interview for 6 hours about his landmark text, Family of Secrets. I've also interviewed him about other things. And in his Who, What, Why blog, he has a series of articles called The JFK Assassination, 60 Years Later, Crucial Alibi Dismantled. And this is from Russ Baker from November 15th of 2023. And it reads, "The strange story of a powerful man who owned the notorious building from which Oswald supposedly killed Kennedy. Was he really hunting in Africa while others hunted the president?" And then Russ goes on to write, "I'd like to introduce you to one of the most fascinating figures you've not heard of, a man whose secretive activities should have gotten the close scrutiny of officials who killed John F. Kennedy had there been a serious investigation. This man owned the building from which we are told Lee Oswald fired the shots that killed Kennedy. He was rich and powerful and well-known in his time. He's all but forgotten today. I came upon him while working on my previous book, Family of Secrets, and trying to understand how it was that Oswald fortuitously obtained a job in the building that turned out to be a critical spot in a motorcade route supposedly determined later. Oswald's presence in that building at that time has always been characterized officially as a stroke of luck for him and bad luck for the company." And by the way, Ruth Payne was linked to Oswald and his fortuitous landing of the job in the Texas School Book Depository. Continuing. Resuming with the last sentence, "Oswald's presence in that building at that time has always been characterized officially as a stroke of luck for him and bad luck for the country. We've always been told that Oswald couldn't have known the details of a not-yet-announced Kennedy visit, and certainly not a specific route for a possible motorcade past a particular building when he applied for his job. So he just happened to be there and then, we are told, decided spontaneously to bring a rifle and kill Kennedy, a highly suspicious concatenation of coincidences. And what does all this have to do with the man who owned the notorious Texas School Book Depository building? We've discovered some things that mean this man will need a close re-examination. Most startling is that he wasn't where he said he was for most of November 1963, and that raises serious questions about why he would engage in a deception, a pretty elaborate one, too, as you'll see, about where he was for the period of the assassination, which was seemingly committed from his building. And then, meet Harold Byrd, LBJ's boss. The man I am talking about is David Harold Byrd, who commonly went by D.H. or Harold Byrd. He's fascinated me for years. Born at the turn of the 20th century, he struck it rich in oil, then expanded over the years until he became a true cross-industry tycoon with major holdings in everything from uranium mining to military contracting. He acquired a high-powered set of friends, in particular Lyndon Johnson, one of John F. Kennedy's opponents for the 1960 Democratic nomination, a man who made it known he hated the Kennedys, was jealous of them, and couldn't wait to be president himself, though he also knew he was unlikely to win the office outright at the ballot box. Johnson told a friend he was well aware that numerous presidents had died in office, and being a betting man, he'd pick his chance in accepting the vice presidential slot under Kennedy. Byrd and Johnson were really close, so close that Byrd was not above trying to boss Johnson around, and that is no small claim. Once piloting his private plane, Byrd radioed Johnson at his ranch and announced he was going to land. President Johnson must have been busy because he told Byrd not to. bird went ahead and landed anyway. Keep that in mind when you consider the amazing stroke of luck that Oswald got a job in Byrd's Palace building before any ordinary citizen could have known that a presidential motorcade would pass by. And then consider that some people did know, the very people who were working on and pushing for the motorcade to happen, including Pexham Lyndon Johnson, a man whose political career was teetering on the brink and whose own people were instrumental in managing Kennedy's trip to Dallas from day one. There also seems to have been an intent to obscure the importance of Byrd's building. Even at this late date, 60 years after the fact, it's unclear exactly who made the fateful decision to divert the motorcade from its initially planned route straight down Main Street onto instead a sharp dogleg turn that would take it past the book depository at low speed. Conflicting accounts given by Secret Service agents and Dallas police officers over the years have only further muddied the waters. And Johnson and his associates, including Texas Governor John Connally, repeatedly insisted, despite much evidence to the contrary, that it was JFK and the White House pushing for the Texas trip all along. Evidence shows Connally was adamant that Kennedy speak at a particular venue, a venue that necessitated the motorcade traveling through downtown Dallas and near the book depository. And then a lineup of linchpins. Okay, but what about Byrd? To understand his significance for the tragedy that played out on November 22, 1963, you need to know something about his circle of a powerful Okay, but what about Byrd? To understand his significance for the tragedy that played out on November 22, 1963, you need to know something about his circle of powerful friends and colleagues. Byrd was close buddies with a whole raft of people at the pinnacle of the national security state, including generals. His own politics were way to the right of his good friend Johnson's. He even traveled to Nazi Germany several years before World War II and had a brief meeting with Hitler. When Byrd returned to the U.S. after that encounter, he spoke positively of Hitler's, quote, sincerity, unquote, and, quote, basically sound policies, unquote. Among his vast web of business holdings, Byrd owned a building in downtown Dallas on the corner of Beale Plaza, an intersection just before one enters a freeway. As an investment, the building had become a bit of a lemon, largely because in the early 1960s, Within a year before Kennedy's visit, though, a new tenant moved in, a firm called the Texas School Book Depository, or PSBD, which distributed books from national publishers to schools throughout the Southwest. The owner of the Texas School Book Depository, Jack Cason, capital C-A-S-O-N, leaned far right himself and had his own military connections. He even headed up a Dallas post of the Military Adjunct American Legion, which was also closely tied to J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI, and the Cold War national obsession with investigating, quote, subversives, unquote. At some point in the year before the motorcade, the exact date has proven oddly difficult to nail down, even the sixth floor museum dedicated to the assassination and located in the building told me they didn't know. At some point in the year before the motorcade, the exact date has proven oddly difficult to nail down, even the sixth floor museum dedicated to the assassination and located in that building told me they didn't know. Cason relocated his operation from nearby to Byrd's building and became the primary tenant, so the building was renamed after Cason's firm. In October of 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald applied for a job with Cason's firm, and even though it was off-season for school book purchases and the firm had laid off non-essential personnel, for some reason it found this unprepossessing applicant with a reputation as a left-wing dissident especially appealing and put him to work, according to an oral history interview with Cason's widow, ostensibly laying flooring and filling the odd book order. As for the Texas School Book Depository Company itself, several former employees have described to me and others company activities, including the apparent covert shipment of things other than books in book cartons, that made clear to them the outfit had its own connections with the intelligence world. In addition, Elzie Glaze, capital E-L-Z-I-E, again the last name capital G-L-A-Z-E, a reporter for the Austin American-Statesman, researched and interviewed Bill Shelley, Oswald's supervisor, and later noted, quote, Mr. Shelley claims to have been an intelligence officer during World War II and thereafter joined the CIA, unquote. Kaysen and his company clearly deserve more scrutiny, but my focus here is on the more powerful Harold Byrd. And the next section of Russ Baker's wonderful article is called Where Was Byrd That Day, Really? Any serious investigation into JFK's assassination would have probed Oswald's path to being in the building that day. That was a central mystery of the assassination. But the Dallas police, the FBI, and the Warren Commission, while going through the motions of scrutinizing how Oswald landed the job when he did, concluded it was all just an uncanny coincidence that a guy with an inclination to assassinate, how many of those are there, unwittingly got the perfect opportunity to do so, which meant they failed to examine Byrd's ownership of the building, which meant they failed to interview him and ask him whether he knew Oswald, whether he knew how Oswald had been hired, etc. And, of course, they never asked Byrd where he was when he learned that his own building had harbored Kennedy's killer. To this day, as I've said, Byrd has eluded scrutiny. But given the cataclysmic import of the events of November 22, 1963, it's surely not too late to open that inquiry. Question number one, where was Byrd that day? Answer, we don't really know, but I've unearthed some strong hints about where he wasn't. Working with a ghostwriter, Byrd later published a vanity autobiography, and although he makes some effort to enliven his life story with anecdotes that might interest general readers, nowhere does he mention November 22nd, his ownership of the Texas School Book Depository building, or his presumed consternation on learning the building's role in the crime of the century. In fact, about the JFK assassination, he says precisely nothing. To me, that's passing strange. Looking deeper into his whereabouts on and around that tragic day, here's one thing I found. There is no evidence that he was in Dallas. We wouldn't expect there to be, because he soon put the word out that he'd been away. But on the other hand, what I also found that definitely aroused my curiosity was an apparent effort by Byrd and his associates to plant stories about him that pointed to his being thousands of miles away from Dallas at that time, on a hunting safari in Mozambique, a place he had never been to before. Why do that? And what was more curious still, the closer I looked into the tale of the safari, the more it seemed that Byrd, with a little help from his friends, had made up that whole story. For reasons that the JFK assassination investigator can only speculate about. I'll take you through the details of what I found, and you can decide for yourself if there's a plausible, benign explanation. Before we get into sniffing around the safari story, it's worth noting that in addition to being close to the man who became president when Kennedy was killed, and hosting the man who ostensibly killed Kennedy, Harold Byrd had a third distinction. He knew a CIA-connected intelligence operative named George Morenfield, who had been asked by the CIA to, quote, keep an eye, unquote, on Oswald a year before the assassination. Even the briefest summary of the connections between Morenfield, Byrd, and Oswald at this time risks sounding like a page from an overheated spy thriller. And again, note the Byrd, Morenfield connection. Continuing. In October of 1962, shortly after Oswald abruptly moved to Dallas from Fort Worth, De Mornfield, who had worked for Byrd years earlier, began helping Oswald and his wife get settled in their new home. At around the same time, De Mornfield set up a charity board and put Byrd's wife on it. One more time. In October of 1962, shortly after Oswald abruptly moved to Dallas from Fort Worth, De Mornfield, who had worked for Byrd years earlier, began helping Oswald and his wife get settled in their new home. At around the same time, De Mornfield set up a charity board and put Byrd's wife on it. Note that Byrd was co-founder and for decades a top leader of the Civil Air Patrol, or CAP, an Air Force auxiliary. I found evidence that it was also used for covert operations, including a plan to send selected CAP recruits to the Army Counterintelligence School in Maryland to, quote, be taught the Russian language, Russian military tactics, Russian politics, and all characteristics of the Russian people, unquote. Sounds a lot like defective training, doesn't it? Well, Byrd, with that, by the way, is Russ Baker saying, that's not an objection by yours truly, continuing with Russ Baker's excellent article. Well, Byrd was commander of the Texas and Louisiana region of the Civil Air Patrol, 1948 to 1953. An eccentric pilot named David Ferry joined one of its Louisiana chapters, eventually becoming a squadron leader. It's now known that Ferry got deeply involved in a range of right-wing activity, including gunrunning and working with anti-Castro Cubans. In 1955, Ferry crossed paths at the Louisiana Civil Air Patrol with Lee Oswald, then a teenage New Orleans air cadet. As we know, some years later, this same Oswald, having somehow taught himself Russian and with a defection to the Soviet Union under his belt, ended up working in a ballast building owned by Byrd. With that as context, setting background, let's return to the question of why Byrd may have gone to so much trouble to create the impression that he was in Africa hunting elephants on November 22, 1963. Well, for one thing, his ownership of the Texas School Book Depository building might have shined an uncomfortable spotlight on his activities around the time of the assassination. Having owned this building for decades and being hands-on, he knew the image of the structure better than anyone else. This is important when you consider how all aspects of the building have been examined and re-examined over the years in an effort to nail down what exactly happened when the President of the United States was gunned down in broad daylight on the street in front of the Texas School Book Depository. Because Oswald, the sole suspect, was killed in police custody 2 days after the assassination, and so never had a chance to tell in detail exactly what he knew, the investigation into the murder revolved around physical evidence at the crime scene, with prime focus on Byrd's building. To reconstruct what happened, investigators had to consider such details as the location of the passenger and freight elevators, and which elevator went up to which floors, the layout of the stairwells, and other potential hiding places, the distances and times it would take for a shooter or shooters to fire their weapons, hide their guns, and descend undetected a number of floors so as to be seen standing as Oswald was on the second floor, calmly holding a soda, when spotted by other employees and a police officer in the building just moments after Kennedy was hit. If I were running a clandestine operation out of that building, I'd want Harold Byrd by my side offering intimate building details as I was dealing with the police radio, the movements of various law enforcement agencies into the building, and so on. I would certainly not want him far away, unreachable, I would certainly not want him far away, unreachable, take three. I would certainly not want him far away, unreachable, in some steamy African savanna. Indeed, Byrd's purported trip came in the last weeks of the local hunting season, when the heat typically became oppressive. Even the safari camp advertised that it closed as of December 1st. But I also wouldn't want him visible in Dallas doing anything publicly. On the other hand, if I were Byrd and I were involved in something of this nature, the first thing I'd worry about is covering my own a blank blank. In short, I'd need a good story should anyone ask questions. Back in the days when there were no cell phones or other modern means of tracking someone away from, quote, civilization, unquote, what better story than being away on an African safari, especially for someone already known to be an avid hunter. In the next section, quote, shot by Harold Byrd, December 7th, 1963, unquote. I sent the photo of the mustachioed man to several people who knew Byrd. None of them thought it was he. Also, the real Byrd was a prob hunter who, like most hunters, routinely posed for pictures next to his trophies. Yet, in the online photo gallery, we see a picture of a dead elephant lying on its side, with two Mozambican guides holding its ears aloft. On the ear is painted, quote, shot by Harold Byrd, December 7th, 1963, and no Harold Byrd standing beside it. What kind of hunter does that? Arguably, only one who's keen to keep his face out of the picture while creating the impression that he, or rather the person being impersonated, was there. And this again in the section, shot by Harold Byrd, December 7th, 1963. And again, the entire article will be in the written descriptions for these programs. It's not as if there aren't some pieces of evidence that Byrd was on safari in Africa for several weeks in late 1963. But on closer examination, this evidence is revealed to be highly dubious. Consider photos posted to an online gallery by Christian von Alvensleben, a nephew of the owner of the safari camp who worked there as a photographer. One shows a man that the photographer was told was, quote, Byrd, unquote. Von Alvensleben remembers him and a companion arriving in early November of 1963 and staying over a month. We cannot reproduce these safari photos on this page for copyright reasons. Sorry about that, but the links take you directly to the photos in question. Take a close look at, quote, Byrd, unquote, the man with a mustache smoking a cigar, and compare it with the ones below whom we consider the real Byrd. Notice especially the eyes. His eyes recede beneath puffy upper lids. His face appears fairly flat because of the brow ridge, forehead, and eyes all seem to be almost on the same plane. His brows are narrow and wispy. The eyes of our presumed impostor are very different. The brow ridge protrudes more, and his brows are bushy and sharply arched. His ears also seem different, and he doesn't seem to have the real Byrd's somewhat pointed chin. He's also less rotund than Byrd was at this stage by almost any measure. This is simply not the same person. And again, repeating this section here, I sent the photo of the mustachioed man to several people who knew Byrd. None of them thought it was he. Also, the real Byrd was a prob hunter who, like most hunters, routinely posed for pictures next to his trophies. Yet in the online photo gallery, we see a picture of a dead elephant lying on its side with two Mozambican guides holding its ear aloft. On the ear is painted, quote, shot by Harold Byrd, December 7th, 1963, unquote. And no Harold Byrd standing beside it. What kind of hunter does that? Arguably, only one who's keen to keep his face out of the picture while creating the impression that he, or rather the person being impersonated, was there. In fact, the purported Byrd was so keen to leave a false trail, that von Alvensleben tells us, throughout his visit, the presumably false Byrd had a brush and a can of paint stowed in the Land Rover during his hunting sorties, apparently waiting for a chance to paint Byrd's name on something big enough. It's hard to avoid the conclusion that the guy who presented himself as Byrd, arriving at the hunting camp 2 or 3 weeks before the assassination, was an imposter. And who could have sent him except Byrd or people acting on his behalf to substantiate the story that Byrd was nowhere near Dallas in late November. The more safari photos you look at, the more doubts arise. The purported Byrd showed up with a companion, an American with a southern accent who called himself Thomas May, capital M-A-Y. And we'll continue with this section. I'll overlap this reading with the reading of Russ Baker's excellent article in the next section of the program. I want to note also that these are the most perilous of times, and with Donald Trump having just appointed Dr. Oz from television to oversee Medicare and Medicaid, and he's going to have Brainworm Bobby overseeing the Department of Health and Human Services, and he just appointed a woman from Fox News to be the Surgeon General of the U.S., and apparently one of her major contributions to our culture is that she feels that a great deal of prayer can be very beneficial for an individual. I think with the other appointments Trump has made for old people being 75 and needing Medicare and Social Security to get by, I think a great deal of prayer might be very much in order. But this is, by way, a characteristically long-winded Dave Emery introduction to an emphatic recommendation. In fact, I'm imploring listeners to do this. Please get the 64-gigabyte flash drive of all of my life's work on it. It will include, by the way, these two programs about Birds of a Feather. Please get that 64-gigabyte flash drive, again, with all of my printed and recorded work, the 33 Conversations with Monty, and a mini library of old anti-fascist books on easy-to-download PDF files. I get no money whatsoever from this flash drive, and there's a link at the top of each written for the record description and at the top of each Food for Thought post that will enable you to obtain the 64-gigabyte flash drive. Again, it's got all of my 46 years, roughly, of work on the air printed and recorded, and all of the magnificent contributions by our contributing editor, Tara Fractal, my conversations with Monty, and the written descriptions for these two shows on it. Please get that 64-gigabyte flash drive when you are attempting to explain to your great-grandchildren why it is that they're living in a rusted-out Chevy sport van and why they have to go out in the morning and fight former Army Rangers for rat-killing turf. You can explain to them what happens. The old children will just crank up a generator, and I'll hook up my computer, and you can see what happened and why it is that we're in the present circumstances that we are in. At any rate, please get that 64-gigabyte flash drive. I get no money whatsoever from that. This concludes For the Record program number 1360, Birds of a Feather, Part 1. This is being recorded on November 23rd of the year 2024. This is Dave Emery saying, thanks for listening.